Do I know you?
You see that girl?
Yeah.
That's Kat Stratford. I want you to go out with her.
Yeah, sure, Sparky.
Look, I can't take out her sister until Kat starts dating. You see, their dad's whacked out. He's got this rule where the girls are...
That's a touching story. It really is. Not my problem.
Motherfucker. I just started fucking talking.
You didn't tell me what we're
doing. I just started fucking talking. Don't talk, Lindsay!
Don't talk. The thing on the head doesn't move, and it's not weird.
Your turn to talk. I'm gonna keep it. Joseph,
that's a junkie.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt hires Heath Ledger to seduce the antisocial Kat so he can romance the beautiful Bianca in the movie that we're going to be talking about tonight. It is the 1999 romance classic, 10 Things I Hate About You. And I can think of exactly 10 things I hate about Lindsay right now. All of them involve her interrupting my intro. I am a professional. I will not stand for this. My name is Shannon Young. This is Extras and Epilogues. I'm going to be your host tonight. With me, of course, my co-host and otherwise also host, Double H is here with us.
You know, my favorite thing about your description, your synopsis for the movie, was that you went with the male actors' names, but the female characters' names.
Son of a bitch, I did. All right. Take two. Here we go.
It was an interesting choice, but I went with it.
I had it all planned out. I was going to say, new student Joseph Gordon-Levitt hires of Heath Ledger to seduce Julia Stiles, so yes. He... can, you know, hook up with Larissa Olniak, and Lindsay immediately sabotage the entire intro. And
she hits you with the chunky. That's chunky.
Don't talk. Don't come over here, Lindsay.
I mean, is it really a normal the best thing part is if she had gone
downstairs? She should have come downstairs to check on me, and I could have yelled at her.
Your camera, don't come over here.
Tonight's special guest, as we talk about 10 Things I Hate About You, is of 90s rom-com purveyor Lindsay Wolfgang.
She sells them?
I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, I'm sure I watched most of them from that decade, but...
I mean, she had to sell this one.
That doesn't mean I remember all of them.
She had to sell this one. This one I remember. I don't remember if I watched this movie by myself or if Lindsay talked me into watching it. I think I watched it before I met her, but I'm honestly not 100% positive.
I don't remember making you watch it, so...
The thing I remember most about this film, and I said it a couple weeks ago, or last week when we said we were doing the show, because last week, of course, we did Office Space with Cody, and yes. When we said we were going to do 10 Things I Hate About You, I remember the first thing I could think of was first off was what a crush I had on Larissa, but second was how much I disliked Julia Stiles at the time. I did not find her an attractive person. That's two things. One is the reflection on what a shallow son of a bitch I can be sometimes. And two, also how inherently wrong I am, because I now, as an adult, as someone with a functioning brain, I actually really like Julia Stiles. I think she's a great actress, and I think she's a lovely person. And going back and watching this film again today, reminded me, or it was like, man, I didn't realize how great she was in this movie and also how pretty she is.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same thing with Jennifer Aniston. I never found Jennifer Aniston appealing until years after Friends went off the air and watching, I think I watched Leprechaun again. Because, you know, if you remember, she was in the first Leprechaun movie.
Yeah.
Wow, he took a deep cut.
Yeah, and I was like, my God, Jennifer Aniston's gorgeous. What's wrong with me? I did the same thing with Heather Graham. Sometimes these women, and Uma Thurman. I see them
Maybe
and I go,
just
I don't
like
get
like the bandwagon.
I wonder if it was popularity. Because that was the epitome of popularity at that time, all of those people that you discussed.
Yeah,
I know for a fact I didn't see this movie in theaters. But I also distinctly remember seeing it in high school.
Yeah.
So, because I started high school in 99. My freshman year was in the fall of 99. But this came out in in March 31st of 99, 10 Things I Hate About You came out. So I definitely would not have seen it in theaters because I would have been going from middle school to the eighth grade. That was a little bit above my pay grade at that time.
Right.
Once it hit, you know, I'm assuming DVD and not VHS within the next couple of years. I know I saw it at least once or twice. Probably saw it again once or twice in college, but don't really remember it. The first time I remember watching it is with my wife. And so she and I watched it again yesterday, and I thought it was pretty great. At one point in time, she got up to do something and was like, hey, you don't have to pause it. I'll be back in a minute. I was like, oh, okay. You know, and I knew she'd seen it quite a bit. She came back, and instinctively, because anytime that we watch a movie and something like that happens, we'll go to explain. I went to explain or say some line, and she literally just verbatim finished it for me, and she goes, I had a real big crush on Heath Ledger a long time ago. You don't have to explain anything about this movie to me.
Who didn't? Also,
yeah.
I was watching, I think it was Morning Joe, but it might have been a different show. It was a news show today, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt was on there, and he was talking about he was talking about the strike and all that, and I forgot how much I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's a great actor. I saw him on Third Rock from the Sun. That was the first thing I ever saw him on, and hated it. Hated him, hated that show, only liked John Lithgow, didn't care for anything else. But I went back and, you know, started watching parts of this movie, and I don't know. I'm not a big rom-com kind of guy, in full disclosure.
Yeah.
Let me be honest with the audience here. This is not really my cup of tea. That's why we have Lindsay here. I'm more of the blood and gore variety, but Lindsay, I know for a fact, adores this movie. And not just the movie, but everything that goes into it, and especially the soundtrack and the band Letters to Cleo, which Lindsay introduced me to. I didn't know who Letters to Cleo was, and I'm a big fan of them now, too, because of that. I mean,
this movie introduced me to them as well, so.
And introduced them to the roof of a school and a helicopter.
Until I rewatched this past week, I didn't realize the band was actually in the movie.
I still didn't realize they're in the movie.
And Save Ferris is the other band that's on the soundtrack. They're the one playing at prom, and it's the actual band on the stage also.
And then Letters to Cleo shows up anyway, or at least the lead singer does. So they're all over the movie. Yeah, since we're talking about the music, so I looked up a few little things, and I don't always put all the trivia that comes to mind on here. At the end of the movie, over the ending credits, Letters to Cleo is literally on the roof of the school playing the song. So that's real. The lead singer of that band, whose name escapes me right now, she said that the space that the whole band was set up on was about the size of her kitchen. And it was very windy.
Yeah.
A very windy day. Plus, of course, it's 99, or I guess it was probably 98 when they filmed this, so they had to use a helicopter. There were no drones at the time to use for those kinds of aerial shots.
That's adding extra wind.
And not to mention, the director tells them outright, by the way, it costs $500,000 every time the chopper has to lift off, so don't fuck this up. That was a direct quote.
Wow.
It costs $500,000 every time the chopper has to lift off to go around and do a series of things, so don't mess this up.
That's crazy.
Well, he said, don't fuck this up.
That's crazy.
So they literally,
I was just gonna say, it's crazy to think that nowadays with drones, like, it's such an easy shot. Even
it costs nothing,
right? Even the lowest budget film has at least one drone shot in it. Like, someone bought a drone and they're gonna get as much money out of it as possible.
Absolutely. But that helicopter, I remember saying at one point in time in the movie, there were a lot of like aerial shots of things, transitional shots from one space to another, and now I know why, because they leased a helicopter, and so they were going to get the most out of that
right.
helicopter as they could.
So I didn't realize this movie was out in 1999. Real quick, I want to read Hunter's summary of it, because I didn't realize he had put a summary on there. I know I went with my own thing. I could have read this and not screwed it up. A high school girl is forbidden from dating until her older sister does so, leading to a wildly complicated series of payoffs, betrayals, and surprises from the guys interested in them. It's a retelling of The Taming of the Shrew. It's one of those modern takes.
Yeah, some interesting, and I assume Lindsay knows this stuff too, but the audience might not, some interesting little ties into Shakespeare. The obvious one, obviously, is the two characters that become like Shakespearean type characters as the movie goes on. And then their names escape me as well, but it's David Krumholtz, who was, of course, Bernard in the Santa Claus movies, his character,
is it Michael,
and Julie Stiles. That sounds right. And Julia Stiles' best friend.
It's either Michael or Martin, and the girl's Mandela.
Mandela, yeah.
It's the Mandela
effect.
They
end up being very Shakespeare obsessed. But there's a lot of little nods to the whole Taming of the Shrew thing. They use several direct quotes from that. I pine, I burn, that whole thing is from that play.
Probably the hate with the fire of a thousand suns is probably from it also.
Character names are big too. So Heath Ledger's character's name is Patrick Verona. Both parts of that are Shakespearean. Verona, right. Of course, Verona, is where obviously Romeo and Juliet is set. But Patrick is a play on Petruchio, who is the main male character in Taming of the Shrew. Both of the female characters in that play also named Bianca and Katerina. We know that that's Kat's full name because her dad says it when he's first introduced. I didn't know this one until I looked it up. The name of the school that they attend, which we'll talk more about later because I have a lot of thoughts on that school. Padua, P-A-D-U-A, which I thought was a weird name for a school. Yeah, it's because it's the name of the city that the Taming of the Shrew takes place in.
Yeah.
So they put all that together. And then, oh, there was one more that was just on the tip of my tongue that they were using. Truccio, Verona, Katerina, and Bianca.
Horatio. Sands.
Horatio's not in it. At one point in time, he watched the film.
He watched the movie, yeah.
I think those are the main ones that I remember. But yeah, there's a lot of little nods to Shakespeare over the course of this. I mean, to be fair, they even directly mention it in the English class. Boy, can we talk about the school for a minute? So full disclosure, I love this movie. I think this movie is great. But I have some thoughts on how it portrays the most unrealistic high school I've ever seen in my life.
So the first thing I thought was like dress code. I'm like, these girls would not be getting away
not
with what
chance.
They're wearing at
and,
all.
And, I mean, even in 99, they're not going to get away with this. Even considering that it's 1999, the way that the English teacher talks to them and the way that they talk back to him. Yeah, the cursing in the classroom, cursing directly at each other.
I mean, the principal does the same thing, but...
So I didn't know this until recently. She's the guidance counselor. I also thought she was the principal.
She's not even the principal? Okay.
And that's even worse, right? She's the guidance counselor. She should be talking to them that way.
That's terrible guidance.
Yes. That's although it is Allison Janney, who is a great actress.
Though.
I love Allison Janney. But I don't want to get into too many details about why I know that's not how high school works, but let's just say I got a pretty good idea.
Well,
and that's not how you can do things.
You've been to high school. You went to high school. You spent a couple of years there. I do not love this movie, for the record.
I assumed as much.
I don't dislike this movie, though.
It's just not your flavor.
There are certain things I really like about it. It's a fun movie. It's a fun movie. It's a good movie. It's just, again, I'm not much of a rom-com kind of person. This movie came out in 99, though. You mentioned you don't think you saw it in theaters. I just want to state for the record, I don't know if I ever told this story on the show before. Up until 99, I had seen exactly two films in theater, for the record. The first was when I was a child. And my school took us to the theater to watch.
I know where this is going.
The all-time classic, Songs of the South.
Oh, no. I remember this story
now.
We
watched
I forgot
Songs of the South in theater. That was the first movie I ever saw in theater. The second movie I ever saw in theater was Godzilla, which came out in 1998. So,
Oh man, I thought it was 97.
I didn't go to the movies a lot as a kid. I got to go to basically whichever Disney movie came out each year. And then once I was 13, my cousin Sarah was obsessed with Jim Carrey and no one would go to the other movies with her. So she would drag me along to the other movies as long as mom would give me money for it. And other than that, I didn't get to go see a lot of films. And I definitely didn't watch in theater. Once it hit Stars, I watched it all the time. So I probably didn't get to see it till 2000, maybe early 2001.
Dude, I went
on there. I watched
everything.
It a crap ton.
Yeah, as a kid, I mean, you couldn't get me out of the theater. I remember the first couple of things I went and saw with my parents were The Rocketeer and is it Aristocats? That's not what I'm thinking of. Oliver and Company.
Oliver and Company.
I saw that and that The Rocketeer and Home Alone, all three I remember seeing with my parents. After that, it started becoming went and saw Jurassic Park. I distinctly remember seeing Jurassic Park in the theater with my cousin.
My parents would take me to Jurassic Park. They told me.
Neither would mine, but my cousin did.
I didn't have family that I could rely on, unfortunately. But my parents fucking tricked me. They said, literally, it was that scene out of Futurama where they're like, sure, you can vote for Skinadle. They told me, sure, we can go to the theater and watch Jurassic Park, or when it comes out on VHS, I'll buy it for you. And I was like, okay, so I can go see it one time or I can have it forever. So I chose the latter, and they did live up to their promise, and they bought it for me on VHS when it came out. That is also one of the only times that I've read a, if there's a movie based on a book, this is I think legitimately the only time I've read the book before I saw the movie, because I could not get a hold of the movie, but they had the book at the school, like the book fairs and stuff, so I picked that up and read it. And this was the only time that I watched a movie and went, well, that ain't how it happens.
You know? Did you have the actual book, or did you have the movie adaptation book like I did?
I had both, legitimately. I read the novelization first.
I had the movie one where halfway through the book you have photos from the movie.
I had that, and then I actually had the full-on Michael Crichton book. Anyway, we're not here to talk about...
I'm shaky enough, man. I'm shaky enough right now.
We're not here to talk about Jurassic Park. That'll be another time one day. Talking about 10 Things I Hate About You, this, you know, that time period, especially late 90s, early 2000s, especially the 90s, I just remember all of the teen comedies coming out. And I was a teenager at the time, so this really should have spoke to me. And I wasn't as big into horror films back then, so I actually liked this movie more back then than I do now. And again, it's not to say that I don't like the film, it's just not my cup of tea. But I do remember at the time when this came out, I was really obsessed with it. Because again, Larissa, is it Olenek or Olenek?
Olenek.
Yep. Which,
and I know this primarily because
of the two that I knew from the film, because of Third Rock from the Sun and
Alex Mack.
Secret World of Alex Mack. And I loved the Babysitter Club movie, and she played Dawn in it.
Don't know what that is. Thank you.
She had also been on Boy Meets World, and I was going to say that's how I know for sure that's how her name is pronounced, because I remember them saying it on Nickelodeon several times too, because of Alex Mack. I also watched a lot of that. But Ryder Strong, who played Sean Hunter on Boy Meets World, is and was good friends with her. She played one of his girlfriends on Boy Meets World as a guest spot, and so he's mentioned her name several times.
She's fantastic. I've always loved her.
Yes.
And I love.
Interestingly, Julia Stiles went in for her role. She went in for Bianca, and she really wanted the role of Bianca. Actually, her agent had been given strict instructions, like that's the role she wanted, and she kind of had to be talked into auditioning for Cat. But of course, in the end, that worked out a lot better. Also, she's supposed to be what, at least 2 years older than Larissa, because she's a senior and Bianca's a sophomore. They are 3 months apart. Julia Stiles is 3 months older than her.
It's not the same thing, but I don't know why that just makes me think of Supernatural, where you had Jeffrey Dean Morgan playing Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki's father when he's only so much older than them. Not nearly to that point.
Well, one of the things I remember as we were watching this, because this is the first time I've seen it in years. I know Sarah and I watched it together, but not, I think, even since we moved into this house. So you're talking at least 7 years. One of the things that caught my attention that we talked about a lot afterward is that most of the people in this movie look age appropriate. The teenagers look like teenagers. Because most of those people were indeed still teenagers or just on the cusp, like 20 or 21.
This isn't a Beverly Hills 90210 situation.
Except for Gabrielle Union, who, first of all, I straight up forgot was in this movie until that happened. And then I knew it was coming when I looked it up anyway. Gabrielle Union was 28 years old. Playing alongside people almost 10 years younger than her. It happens every time.
Yeah.
That catches me off guard.
That's
crazy.
I can't repeat what my friend Jess, who is black, would say, so I'm just going to leave it there.
I think we all know. I think we all know where this was going. It's the same mentality I was just talking about Boy Meets World as Trina McGee, who played, again, Sean's long-term girlfriend later in the series, Angela. She had a kid at the time that she was playing a teenager alongside these other people. She was like in her 30s, if I remember correctly.
Oh, that's Charisma Carpenter in Buffy the Vampire Slayer was significantly older than a teenager whenever she did that role. some people can pull it off. This movie, to me, was the quintessential rom-com of the 90s. This was like, this was my thing. There was a lot of them. There was what, She's All That. Yeah. There was
Can't Hardly Wait.
Can't Hardly, which is also a really good one, to be fair.
I love Can't Hardly Wait.
But 10 Things I Hate About You, to me, was always like the smart like teen comedy, and I always liked it.
It is.
And they don't talk down to the audience in it's flat out use larger vocabulary and don't make any attempt to
it's Shakespearean,
dumb it down,
you know, like
it's not just an adaptation of Shakespeare, it's that they really kept that whole mentality behind it.
The critics also liked it. Critical reception: 71% positive critic review on Rotten Tomatoes, 70 out of 100 on Metacritic. Cinema score of a B on an A+ to F scale. So the crowds loved it. $13 million budget versus a $60 million worldwide box office, which I know nowadays doesn't seem like very much, but at the time, I mean, that was pretty significant.
It's pretty big.
Yeah. Some movies.
And this is in a year that we'll talk about it, I'm sure, at some point in time down the line, continuing, you know, whenever we continue the 90s list, or the 99 list anyway. But this is the same year that American Pie came out, that Election came out, not, of course, a romantic comedy, but like movies that were all sort of kind of meant in that same vein for the same age range,
right?
Teenagers, but like intelligent teenagers, again, like Lindsay said, who didn't want to be talked down to.
American Pie,
so stupid. For it to do that well, absolutely. But for it to do that well against those kinds of movies targeted at the same kind of audience, even in that year, is pretty impressive.
I'll tell you why it was so successful against those films is because you take a movie like American Pie, you've got Jason Biggs, you've got Sean William Scott, or you can go look at Heath Ledger for, you know, close to 2 hours. Now, Lindsay, as a woman with womanly desires, if you had to pick between Jason Biggs, who you're currently trying to picture in your head and can't, and that's okay.
I mean, I'm assuming it's one of the guys from American Pie.
It is. It's the main guy. He fucked the pie. Yeah.
He fucked the pie. And what is he saying? Jay and Silent Bob, it always comes back to that fucking pie.
Well, Hunter, in jail, he'll be the pie.
In prison.
Yeah. Heath Ledger was such a good-looking guy and such a fantastic actor, and then combined with everybody else in this movie, it's a good cast. That was my favorite part of this film, is it's a fantastic cast. Everyone looks age-appropriate. Everyone's well-acted. I put this up there. I know it's not the exact same thing because they're two very different films, but just the modernization of, like, Shakespeare, this is probably my favorite one, other than, you know, I think the cliched one being Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes.
They still kept the actual, like, text, but they just changed location and atmosphere.
They changed the setting.
Part of the Heath Ledger, Baz Luhrmann trilogy, which I will never stop talking about, which is Romeo and Juliet, Ballroom, was it Ballroom Dancing? It's Ballroom something. And
that sounds right.
And Moulin Rouge, of course.
Yes.
Oh, I love Moulin Rouge.
This is one of Heath Ledger's first American movies, if not the first one. He had acted a little bit in Australia
first.
This
was my introduction to him, for sure.
Yes,
same.
Yeah, this was his big, like, worldwide breakout role. I still think it's very funny that later, I mean, you would have Heath Ledger doing so many different kinds of characters. I mean, you know, he does A Knight's Tale where he's actually, you know, British rather than having the Australian accent. He does the affectation. He does an iconic now voice as the Joker, of course. He was the first one to really put that particular spin on the Joker before he tragically passed. But it's very funny to me that in this movie, it doesn't seem like he got any direction on that accent at all. Sometimes he's kind of Australian, sometimes he's not. I think they were just like, dude, man, just
do what you want.
Just do whatever you want to do, and we'll, your like, hands. You look like that, it'll be fine.
When exactly. When you look like that, you can pretty much say, you can sound however you want.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
I just laugh when you go back to that. Picking between Heath Ledger and the other ones, the quote that just pops in my head is like, I'm not a pretty guy.
Yeah, there's I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't seen the Barbie movie. I don't think this is a spoiler, but we considered talking about it tonight too. Sarah actually said, because she and I saw that a few days ago, when that bit comes up where they're like, she's into pretty guys, that they should have just had Helen Mirren go, note to the filmmakers, do not cast Heath Ledger when you're going to use this line on him. He improvised a lot too. I thought it was I saw it happen, and I thought that they didn't script that. The little bit where he goes to light a cigarette from the Bunsen, or not the Bunsen burner, the gas burner in the science classroom, and then he just plays with the flame, like he just keeps running his fingers. Yeah, he just did that that was not scripted.
Yeah, too much, well, he's Australian. They're notoriously fire resistant.
And he's the bad boy. Like, at that point in the movie, everyone's afraid of him. They don't know what's going on with him. And so
All right, so I didn't watch the full movie, in full disclosure. I read the Wikipedia, and it brought back memories. Why was he the bad boy again? Did he ever do anything where they explicitly said why he was feared, or is it just because he was Australian?
He was missing for school for a year, and so just, like, wild, crazy assumptions came out of it.
This was so for the kids at home, this is pre-social media, right? 1999 means that you might have ICQ or AOL Messenger. Yeah, that's it. So there's no social media. There's no, if you had a cell phone, it was a rarity, and you probably weren't even texting. You had it to make
phone calls. More likely to have a pager than a cell phone.
In fact, the dad in the movie, as a doctor, does indeed have a pager. And he's great, by the way. I want to talk more about him later.
I love that actor.
He's so good.
Yeah. So good. Kissing he's is so not what has me up to my elbows and placenta every day. Anyway, but yeah, so this is pre-social media. This is a person who, again, at a very stereotypical, like almost so over the top type high school it literally can't exist, goes missing for a year and doesn't have the ability to control that narrative. He also is the kind of person who, like Kat, doesn't really care what people think about him. So when he comes back and the rumors have grown and spread to a crazy wild level, it reminds me of that bit
in entire duck.
He ate alive, everything but the beak and the feet. That movie Easy A that came out a few years ago with Emma Stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the same mentality Scarlet as her character in that movie. Yeah, I'm not gonna argue what people think about me. If that's what they want to think, great, I'll just lean into it. And so he kind of does. He doesn't try to dispel any of those rumors. It seems to make his life easier. He doesn't have to deal with people. He also has one of my favorite bits is so great early in the movie when he busts in the English classroom and goes, "What did I miss?" And they kind of tell him, and he goes, "Great." And he just turns around and walks out. That's a good bit, man. That's a funny bit. It's a nice little beat.
I forgot how much didn't like Andrew Keegan in this movie. You're not supposed to.
No, he's absolutely meant to not be liked.
Yeah.
He could not be.
He was the one playing Joey.
He's Joey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He could not be a more stereotypical 90s like rich boy villain.
Bag. Yeah.
Man, he pulls it off so well. It's fun to watch him chew the scenery with that.
Yeah, I decided to look up him as an actor and see what else he's been in, and not a lot that you're gonna recognize, and that surprises
me. It's weird.
I thought he was
it
in
seems
more.
Like he'd be super visible. I Sarah and I were talking about this, and we came to the conclusion that I think he looks like a lot of other actors from around that time those kind of roles.
And to me, he looks exactly like what's his dick, you know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
He has a Mario Lopez look.
He was the guy that was on. He was on the Eric Andre show. He's the one that flipped out on him and was like, you know, how are you ever going to have a job doing this when you know you're messing with people? Yeah, write it down. You know, all the people that don't want to be on your show. And I can't remember the name of the guy now. And now it's bothering me. And now I'm going to look it up.
But I think
it's
the same. It's the same type of deal. Yeah, he's one of those guys who just has a.
He looks like Eric Balfour.
Yeah, he has a super. I don't want to call it a generic look, but he and like 16 other guys look exactly like that.
They're the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same kind of deal.
I'm literally.
It's bothering me. I gotta mention this too, because we were talking about the school earlier. This is bothering me if I don't get it out of there. The last thing that bothered me about the school itself was that I was like, is it a private academy? What is it? Because they keep showing this crazy building. Like, there's no way that's a high school unless it's a private school or it's a prep college or something.
Well, the that actual is a, building they used as an art school.
Well, but at one point in time, it was, in fact, a real high school. And
was
the
it?
Only
that's
reason
cool.
it looks that. Yeah, the only reason it looks that ostentatious is that before that, when it was built as a train depot / hotel. So it was built as like a like a super nice, like you would ride the rail into that area. It's in northwest it's in the northwest of the US, somewhere in Washington State. Because at one point in time Bianca and Cameron go underneath a bridge and there's like this kind of troll sculpture.
Is that in Washington? Because one of my employees says he went to that school because I was talking about how we were gonna do this. He's like, "Oh hey, fun fact." And I'm pretty sure he said it was Tacoma School of the Arts or something like that.
Well, yeah, so the thing under the... Go ahead.
I got some bad one.
I was going to say, the thing under the bridge is, it's called the Fremont Troll. It's a well-known, like, sculpture around there, and that kind of gives away where they are. But that building, the rail lines used to meet there, and they had, like, it was basically the Grand Central Station of the West Coast. So they had this really ostentatious, like, train depot, and then a really nice hotel built into it. It suffered some fire damage, and they couldn't use it to do that anymore. And then it was bought and renovated as a school and used for multiple. Yeah, but apparently it was Stadium High School is what it was called for a while. But interestingly, that famous scene of Patrick performing the song to Kat. Stadium High School. No. The football field is indeed theirs, but they didn't have a marching band.
The school
did not have a marching band. They had to borrow a marching band from another nearby school because the school, of course, had to sign off on them filming everything there. They filmed everything on location. They built no sets for this whole thing. So anytime you see them at a house, that's a real house that they rented. The paintball fight takes place at a place called the Seattle Gas Works, which is a real place that you at that time could go and do those things. But the high school that they were at, the reason they have a stadium is because they were a big soccer school and a big like field hockey school. They didn't have a football team, and so they didn't have a marching band, because generally you don't have a marching band if you don't have a football team.
Right.
So they had to hire another another marching band from a nearby school. The guy that Patrick pays off in the hallway, like the brief shot you see of him doing that before you see him messing with the and getting the mic,
is the actual
like, band leader. Yep,
that's
he
awesome.
Got a role in the movie because he was the leader of that band, and so all he had to do was stand there, take the money, and like smile and nod, and he got to be.
That's awesome.
Oh yeah, so it's a good origin story.
I put two pictures in the chat. Lindsay, tell me which one is Andrew Keegan and which one is Eric Balfour.
I only know because I looked him up yesterday.
The top one is the one from the movie.
That's true.
And the bottom one's the other person.
I guess she's got it right. Yeah. But they look eerily similar, and I don't care.
Yeah, no, that's very, very similar.
Shanna, did you watch at least up to the scene where he performs Can't Take My Eyes Off of You in the stadium?
Not today, but I do remember that scene. I remember most, as I was reading the Wikipedia.
I can't help but smile during that. Like, it just,
it's a great, iconic scene, and it's the thing that everybody knows from this movie. However, I do want Shannon to go back and watch it at some point in time, because they clearly didn't tell Heath Ledger what to do with the faders on the board, because he pumps up one speaker way louder than the other for some reason. Like, I forget if it's left or right. One of them goes halfway up, and the other one goes all the way. The only one he gets right, I mean, he pushes the master up, and then he pushes his volume all the way to the top, which I expected. But as that happened, I was like, why does he want one speaker louder than the other? And Sarah goes, I knew you were going to say something about that. She goes, I could see that scene in my head, and I was like, I know when that happens, I'm just going to look at that and go, he's doing that wrong. I never figured that way. I think they just told him to just play with them. I don't know.
Just push buttons.
What I really like about films like this is how absolutely absurd the romantic gestures are in this film that no man could ever actually live up to, because no one's going to look like Heath Ledger, and then no one's going to sing a song to a girl like Heath Ledger did. It's like porn for women. It sets an unrealistic expectation for men that we cannot hit.
There's plenty of unrealistic expectations out there. So.
It's unfair. The best I ever did is I drew a picture for Lindsay, and I made a Mario level for an ex-girlfriend. That's the best I got. I'm not getting on stage, you know, at school with a marching band singing a song. I don't have it in me.
As much as I love,
I was in the marching band. I played trombone.
As iconic as that scene is, and as grabbing, I mean, it is just heart-meltingly good. Why did the cops take him away? What did he do wrong? What was so bad about it?
He didn't get permission from the school.
I was going to say he didn't get permission from from Frankie Valli.
And I say again, I really do love this movie, but it's so hard not to pick it apart at times. The worst scene in the whole movie. How in the world did they think it was a good idea to have Kat flash the teacher
to get him out of detention? That's
so first of all,
I taught you that. He never reacts,
which is super weird. Yeah, it's a great line. He never reacts. It's super weird. He just stands there. They all applaud her. apparently she never gets in trouble for it, but everyone knows about it because Patrick even references it at the end that he found out what happened. Yeah, as they're
not every girl will flash flash a guy to get you out of detention. Yeah,
it's a weird scene, man. It's a very and everything I read about it as people were reminiscing, they're like, man, if you've never seen this, you should go back and watch it, or you should go and watch it if you have seen it. Go back and watch it again. Can we talk about the scene where she flashes the soccer coach? That's super weird, isn't it?
That's one of those things that it's like, oh, you can't get away with that nowadays. No, you can't, because teenage high school girls should not be flashing teachers.
No, it's very strange.
When I was in grade school, this is a true story. When I was in grade school, there was this girl that I guess she just loved attention. We were in like fifth, sixth grade. And me and my friend, we would sit there and she would like get our attention. And then she would like pull her shirt down or up and flash us constantly. But we were also kids.
Oh my God.
If she was doing that to the teacher, that teacher better say something or else he's in for a bad time.
Not okay.
Right.
It's not a good idea.
It's not a good look. And that she went to better show my breast to get him out of class. Not.
It's misdirection.
It's the classic. It's the classic wrestling trope. The girl gets on, you know, the apron. She flashes the ref or the wrestler and everybody goes nuts. I am glad at least that the guy didn't react to it, because most of the times in films, if a girl flashes a guy like that, they look at her like they've never seen breasts before. they didn't even know women had those. I always think back
he was more concerned with the bag of weed and the Cheetos he took.
Do you remember, which is another
kind of weird little scene, but I guess it was just to establish that he's like not a great person anyway, which I guess is why he doesn't react to her. I don't know. It just feels like a weird setup to
me. Do you remember, this is a little bit off topic, but it's not quite off topic. Do you remember Killer Instinct for arcade and Super Nintendo?
Absolutely.
It had fatalities. It was, you know, you beat a guy to death, you murder him, you rip him in half, you eat him, whatever.
Yeah.
Except there was a character, and my favorite character to play, her name was Orchid, and she was a green-clad ninja, basically. Her fatality, do you remember what her fatality is? She would flash the other opponent. She would lift her shirt up and show them her breasts, and you wouldn't see her breasts, but you would see from the back. And the opponent, their eyes would bug out, and they would literally explode because they are so turned on by a pair of breasts. So congrats to this teacher for not literally exploding in his pants in front of everybody. That might have cost him his job.
Now, again, for as many things about this movie are just kind of silly and over the top and very cliche and tropey, it does have, like you said, an amazing cast. And I think that's really what pulls it back together. I was reading something that Sarah sent me a while back ago after we watched it, that Julia Stiles in particular had been so appreciative of Heath Ledger in the movie, because he could have easily come in and kind of been the star, especially in a lot of the scenes that they share together. He could have kind of shown her up a little bit. And she said he was so, like, and it doesn't surprise me knowing, you know, how he was later in life before he passed. He was such a giving actor that he would come in and go, how are we going to make this work? Like, what are we going to do to make this scene work? The one that really comes to attention, and I put it toward the bottom here, which, by the way, we were talking about that song. I should have mentioned this at the time. The original song was not meant to be Can't Take My Eyes Off You by Frankie Valli. It was going to be the Partridge Family's I Think I Love You. And that had been licensed out to Scream 2. A couple years prior, and they did that. They could not get the rights to it, so it was Julia Stiles who said, "Oh, we should do this one instead," and they could get it. But the climactic, one of the big climactic scenes, of course, after they've had their big fight, and Kat reads the poem, the eponymous poem from the title of the movie. I remember as she was reading it, I'm watching that scene for the first time in a long time. She messes up one of the lines, and she kind of just jumps over it, like she says one of the words wrong, and then she stops and just keeps going. I couldn't figure out why they left that in. And then I remembered she gets really emotional toward the end of that speech. That's because it was the only take they did of that. It was not scripted for her to get emotional about that speech, about her realizing that she was, or you know, I guess not realizing, but proclaiming kind of that she was still in love with him. And if you watch that scene even closer, they cut to Heath Ledger. They cut to Patrick after she says the line, I don't really hate you, not at all. He's not crying. He's not welling up. She, in an interview years ago, said, you know, he could easily have done that. and kind of taken something from me in that moment. He could easily have made himself to cry a little bit, to tear up, but he didn't. And he told me later specifically, that was your scene. That was not my space to take that. You know, when that genuine reaction came out of you, there was nothing for me to do but react to it in a way that let that still be your scene. I hate that we don't have him around anymore.
Same.
Because, I mean, that's, you just hear that all the time, that that's the kind of actor he was. Which, that he wanted to make the movie work.
I'm almost like, I don't tell that story, but I remember, I've mentioned Kid Craddock on the show before. When Heath Ledger passed away, I used to listen to Kid Craddock all the time in the morning on my way to work. And when Heath Ledger passed, I remember everybody being real sad about it, except Kid Craddock was like respectfully going, you know, like, I'll keep it to myself. Because apparently Heath Ledger had done their show, and when they were talking about it, Heath Ledger just sat there reading a newspaper the entire time, completely uninterested in anything they were saying. And he was like, what a rude person. But everyone else has been like, no, he was fantastic. So maybe Kid Craddock was the asshole, but I can't say that because he's also gone now. So,
well, it's also worth noting, I mean, Heath Ledger, the later he got into his career was, I don't want to say method, but he did sort of play with, you know, the kind of characters he was playing. You would see those personalities come out in him. I mean, at the time that he was playing the Joker, he was into, you know, doing this extreme journaling, and he was keeping himself away from other people. A lot of speculation as to that leading to maybe why what happened with him.
At least he didn't.
It might just be.
At least he wasn't a method actor with the Joker like
Jared Leto.
Like Jared Leto's dumbass,
who weirdly gets a call out in this movie. He's the picture that Kat keeps in her drawer that tells Bianca that she's apparently not a, I forget how she phrases it.
He's not a Katie Lang fan.
I was going to say, she doesn't say friend of Dorothy. That's not it. It's Katie Lang fan. That's what it was.
Wait, what?
There's a part in the movie where Cameron and Bianca are trying to figure out stuff about Kat that they can give to Patrick as ammunition so that he can actually get her to pay attention to it.
Right.
And so they're going through her room and trying to find like stuff about her. And Cameron goes, I mean, not to be rude, but are you sure she's not a, and Bianca goes, Katie Lang fan? No, I found a picture of Jared Leto in her top drawer once, and I'm pretty sure I know why it was there. So
how long has Jared Leto been active? I thought he came around in the late 2000s.
30 Seconds to Mars.
Were they around?
He was
back
playing
then?
With the band.
Wow.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he was playing with his band at that point in time.
Holy shit. I didn't realize he's this old. I thought Jared Leto was younger than me. He is not. He is much older than me. Wow.
No, Jared Leto.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's pretty crazy.
He was part of that.
I did not know that. It's fun to mention with 10 Things I Hate About You, Lindsay, because you're a big fan of the movie, right?
Yeah.
What's your favorite? All right, before I ruin it, what's your favorite part of the movie?
Oh, goodness. That's a hard pick. It really is.
I ask the hard questions on this show.
I don't know. I kind of like the whole like lead up of them of trying to get the plan together to get him to agree to date Kat. Because like one of my absolute favorite parts is totally minor, but it's when he basically blew them off the first time and Joseph's character is just all like, we're screwed. And then the other guy's like, I don't want to hear that defeatist attitude. And he's just all upbeat, we're screwed. It's so dumb, but like, I just love the force. Okay, I'll
it's
be peppy,
bit.
But we're still fucked.
Yeah, see, it's all in how you react to situations. So you're a big fan of the movie then, right?
Yes, I like the movie as a whole. It makes me smile. It makes me laugh. It unfortunately still makes me cry. But
and so you were also a fan.
I really like it.
You were also a fan of the music, and you followed the series, the film around, correct? Like you were a fan in that way.
I mean, I bought the soundtrack. I didn't like actively go hunt for the other bands immediately.
Well, you had the soundtrack.
I didn't exactly have the budget to go buy CDs, and my dad was one of those ones like, do not download anything. You're going to get a virus from everything you do.
And he was right, too. I'll just say, so you like the soundtrack, you like the movie.
Yes.
Did you also like the TV show?
I never watched it. I know it existed, but I never watched it.
I didn't know it existed until today when I was researching for the show. I was unaware.
Yeah.
And the only person that came back from the movie was Larry Miller as the dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody else was...
It was a whole different cast. It was a whole different cast. I might have watched the pilot, but I legit don't remember anything about it.
Which I also found out, Hunter, just as a weird little side note, is that the principal of the TV show was played by Suzy Nakamura, who you may remember better as the therapist or whatever in It's Always Sunny, the intervention episode.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, if you could find that on Hulu, which you may or may not.
Yeah, I was vaguely aware there was a TV show, but there was that thing a few years ago where everybody wanted to make a TV show or a musical
Clueless,
out of
TV
every
show.
80s and 90s. Yeah, and it Scream got a TV series.
And I'm assuming they couldn't afford Ferris Bueller, so they created Parker Lewis, which was just the biggest ripoff.
Which to bring it back around, Jennifer Aniston was on.
What's that, Lindsay?
I enjoyed Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Thank you.
I liked Parker Lewis Can't Lose, too. I always liked Kubiak. The only thing I remember was Kubiak.
Yep.
We didn't really talk about the story of the film. So, normally we give the plot and then we go into... So the basic plot of the film, then we're going to get into the epilogue. And
you went over it.
It's the Taming of the Shrew. It's the same basic concept. And then the ending is where things kind of change.
I still love the dad's quote, new role. You can date when she does, but she'll never date. I like this even more.
The way he reacts to the camera itself, where he just goes, oh, I like that.
That's yes.
It's that little silken, oh, I like that.
So, Hunter, tell us about the ending.
Okay, so, again, the film is just the plot of The Taming of the Shrew. The gist of it, which we've talked about a couple of times up to this point, is that there's a guy who's interested in a girl. She can't date until her sister does, so he's trying to get someone else to date the sister so that he can go out with her. Naturally, as in all these stories, the guy then, of course, falls in love with the other sister, and things get crazy when she finds out that he got paid to do so. So toward the end of the movie, prom happens not too long before the end of it. Bianca learns that Joey's planning to have sex with her that night if they had gone together, which they didn't, because he's mad that Bianca went with Cameron instead, who she finally admitted she had feelings for. Joey reveals that he was the one who was paying Patrick to go out with Kat. She then leaves upset. Joey punches Cameron. He then gets beaten up by Bianca for all the pain that he's caused everybody.
I do very much enjoy that scene, too, where she just punches
him. Oh, yeah. She just wails on
him. It's important to mention, for those that maybe haven't seen the film, for context, that Joey and Kat slept together under pressure from Joey, and that's why Kat is kind of the way she is because she was so badly wronged by him. So he was going to try to sleep with both sisters, which, man, the balls on that guy.
He's exactly as gross as you need that kind of villainous character to be.
Yes.
Basically, at the very end, Bianca reconciles with her sister. Her and Cameron start dating in earnest. Their dad admits that Kat is capable of taking care of herself. He's been holding both of them back for so long. He's worried about what happens when he's no longer needed. He gives her permission to go to Sarah Lawrence College across the country, which is what she's been wanting since early in the film. While she's still pretty upset about the relationship, the English class that she and Patrick were in, they had been given an assignment to write their own version of William Shakespeare's Sonnet 141, which for the life of me, I do not remember the dialogue to. And of course, in the film, it's rapped, which is kind of second-hand cringe. It's awesome, but man, it's hard to watch in a lot of ways, too.
It is, but at the same time, though, I like that they did it.
I like that he did it. It's hard to... You kind of get that secondhand embarrassment, though, because... You got the Rasta kids, and anyway, not the
don't
point.
Even get me started on
don't
YouTube.
Don't even get me started on you.
Don't even get me started.
Kat reads her poem, which is, of course, the eponymous 10 Things I Hate About You. Oh, by the way, that before I wrap this up, one last thing I remembered, the title. People wonder where the title came from. It wasn't just from that. One of the two writers, it was a team of female writers who put this together. One of them had in high school a boyfriend named Anthony, and they had a weird, rocky off-and-on relationship. So she had a list in her notebook called Things I Hate About Anthony. and that turned into 10 Things I Hate About You when they wrote this script. She said that to this day, she and Anthony are still friends, and that occasionally he will call her and say, hey, you know, this person or this nephew of mine doesn't believe that your movie is about me. And so she'll have to get on the phone and be like, yes, I hated Anthony in high school. So Kat reads her poem, which of course reveals at the end that she's not actually, she's still in love with Patrick. She's upset that he upset her, but she's not ready to like let it go. She just doesn't know what to do. She goes to her car later in the day and finds there's a Fender Stratocaster that she had been looking at earlier in the movie that Joey, of course, basically bought because Patrick bought it for her with the money that he paid him to go out with her. They get back together and everything kind of wraps up with a neat little
package.
You can't just buy me a guitar every time you screw up.
And then he just kisses her anyway, just to stop. And you're not gonna. He keeps interrupting her.
Yeah,
because he's a man.
Did you notice, by the way, the two guys who are fighting in the parking lot as the camera? There's two guys that are just punching each other like 10 feet away from where they're making out at her car. There's a lot of weird little background stuff. Sarah also pointed out to me. It's not a character thing unless you can kind of make it one. When the archery teacher gets shot in the butt with the arrow by Bianca, which is a great, like, the sound effect is great. In the background, as Bianca's talking to Joey, they send a student to get help. So she starts jogging across the field, but the scene is getting ready to come to an end, and you can tell no one told this extra not to do anything different. She stops. Yeah, she stops and she looks at the camera, like, from a distance, and the scene just ends. So Sarah goes, oh, watch this little mistake, because she had spotted it. And I was like, okay, but you can justify that by just saying, oh, she didn't really like the English teacher. Or the archery teacher. She just, like, ran a little ways, and I was like,
yeah. Screw it.
It's too far away. I'm tired.
Well, it's a lot of trouble.
It's a lot of trouble.
It's a lot of trouble to do that. So that brings
so
us...
So that's the proper ending.
Right.
But now...
But now we get to discuss what happens after the credits. My version of this is very simple. I'm a realist, all right? I'm the realest guy in the room. Bada boom, can't teach that, etc., etc. What happens is clear. Everyone breaks up. She goes off to college, and that's it. You think they're going to stick together? She's going across whatever for college. Both of them are already damaged people. There's no way in hell that relationship lasts.
I'll give you some additional credence to this, because one version of my post credits for this, if you want to go the dark route, follows that same deal. Sarah Lawrence College is an all girls school.
Oh,
yeah. Okay, so she literally cannot go to college with her.
And yes, with
he can go to that part of the country, but which he cannot attend.
I don't think he would though.
No, in fact, I would almost wager a guess when she goes to college at this all girls school, being the almost like radical semi-feminist that she is, she's going to be gay. She's going to end up with a woman. That's what's going to happen.
Or at least, for the record, Sarah Lawrence is in New York. It's in Bronxville, New York.
Oh, a liberal place like that. Yeah, you're done. You're going to date women after that. Heath Ledger's character, I would assume, no, that's dark.
I'm assuming doesn't even go to college, because just from what he was doing in school, he would probably just go right into the workforce.
His character is still bagging groceries down at Piggly Wiggly. His character is...
He probably went back to Australia and was never seen again.
He got bit by one of those funnel web spiders that are actually very common in Australia. And he's okay. He ended up marrying Kylie Minogue. In my headcanon. What about you, Lindsay? You're a happier person than me, mostly. What do you think happens after
the
credits?
For those two, that is kind of what I was also thinking. Like, obviously, she goes to school... I don't know exactly what Sarah Lawrence is, but I would assume she's probably doing something like English Lit or whatever major-wise.
Something
or else,
gay,
like,
no doubt.
Or maybe law, because she's so, like, right on, like, the righteousness of stuff.
She would have to leave Sarah Lawrence for that. It is a it's a liberal arts school, so you're looking
and that's kind of what I figured.
Yeah, performing arts and all that.
I think that Cameron and Bianca would have a chance, though, like... at least through the rest of high school. I don't know if they would continue on beyond that, but like what they were building up, I felt like those two could have a chance at having a lasting relationship. But Bianca is still a little on the shallow side, but Cameron could rub off on her that maybe be a more normal person.
I mean, if you've seen the way Joseph Gordon-Levitt looks now, yeah, she'd be a fool not to, if she's shallow, like, that's a tasty treat right there.
Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, stay here.
This might change the game. No, no, no. Sarah Lawrence College became co-ed in 1968.
Oh.
So it is not.
I still don't think
he,
Patrick doesn't strike me as a college kind of guy.
No, he would have to get into college.
So I mean, let's look at the timeline. So, by the way, the reason I noticed that is as I was looking at notable alumni, J.J. Abrams popped up, and I was like, now, wait a minute.
He ain't no girl.
J.J. Abrams ain't no girl. So look at the timeline of this movie. The prom takes place ostensibly a night before all of this happens. Prom generally happens in the high school like hierarchy in the timeline sometime in April, mid to late April, like about a month to 6 weeks before graduation. They're not that far off from graduation. There's no indication to me in this movie that Patrick is going to graduate. He doesn't seem like he's on track to graduate.
Right.
And again, it's not a private school, even though it's in like an ostentatious building. It seems to be a public school, because even though the girl's dad is a doctor, and I mean, he says he just wrote a check for her to go to Sarah Lawrence College. They've got some money. It doesn't seem like the other students are on that same line. Like a few of them are, but not all of them. Yeah. So it's probably a public school. It doesn't seem like he's going to graduate, and this seems like the sort of university that's going to require a lot more than just a plucky attitude and a willingness to learn to get in.
Okay, but what about how attractive he is?
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think they go to the same school, but I do think that there is – so I'll give you the happier ending. I think he follows her. I think he does follow her and at least tries to make it work. And I think he goes straight into acting. I think he goes into like a low key, you know, film school, or not film school, acting school, like, or even stage acting. And that's their, if they're going to stay together, that's the way it probably happens, because she's more of a writer, as I recall. That was why she was going there, was for a writing degree. Of course, you could also say that she goes there and becomes a ballerina who eventually learns also how to hip hop dance.
That's a terrible movie. No,
shut your mouth.
Hey, she got if IMDb is to be believed, she got the role in Save the Last Dance because of the table dance she does in 10 Things.
Doesn't
I Hate
that
About
one?
You. So,
and for flashing the teacher.
I don't know about that. Not so much that.
Julia, you know, of everybody in there, I feel like Julia, other than Andrew Keegan, Julia Stiles probably has the least impressive resume for acting.
She was very much, I don't want to say a flash in the pan, but yeah, it was, she had a moment. She lived a moment, and that was kind of it.
I think she also made the decision to stop early, though, because she had other things that she wanted to do.
She still acts, for the record. She was in, I'm looking at IMDb right now, she was in the Orphan sequel, which, I mean, I'm not a big fan of that movie, but, you know, it is what it is. She was in the Bourne series, which is, I mean, that's a huge one right there.
Yeah, which I totally forgot.
She was in a little, Out of the Dark horror film in 2007, I think? Oh, 2014, that I thought was actually pretty good. It wasn't fantastic, but I liked it. That was actually the first time I'd seen her in a very, very long time. She was in Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah, she's been in a bunch of stuff, but like compared to Joseph Gordon-Levitt or, you know, especially Heath Ledger, I mean, even though she was like kind of the star of the film, I feel like she got the least out of it.
I mean, you could say that, but then to be fair, Larissa Olenek also kind of, she didn't do a whole lot after this. Like, there were a few things, but she made her way. Yeah, she made her way out of the limelight pretty quickly there, too, because she was also somebody who sort of had a moment in that mid to late 90s outing, and then she came back and did a bunch of almost kind of random things in the 2000, like 2010 to 2020 range. Looks like she was doing some voice work and a couple of short films.
She was also in Third Rock from the Sun. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, she played his girlfriend, ironically. She played Joseph Gordon-Levitt's
character. That is so strange.
Yeah, well, that happened after this movie. I think, honestly, because if I remember correctly, they had seen this and thought, well, you know, we need her on as a guest star, or we need somebody in as a guest star anyway, and they've already got charisma. Although, unfortunately, if I didn't look too deep into it, but if I saw it correctly, that was coming from a DVD commentary that Larissa had done for this movie, and she made a quick allusion to, yeah, we were not on the best terms at that point. So evidently she and Joseph Gordon-Levitt weren't getting along for whatever reason. Well, yeah, I think there's that. I think because it's a romantic comedy, there's got to be a possible, you know, happy ending. And I think that's what it is that he becomes more of the blue collar working man type character that follows her there, while she goes through the more, like you said, the more liberal arts type degree. And you like to think that Bianca's not as shallow as she was at the beginning of the movie.
But she's still pretty though, and rich. So
She's a sophomore in high school. So to be fair, one thing I didn't love, you know, Cameron kind of feels like entitled to her. Like when they have that little argument in the car before she kisses him, he's like, you know, I put in all this work, and then you just blow me off anyway. And it's like, you know, if she's not into you, dude, that's sorry about it. I mean, apparently she is, and that's great. But there was a moment of him just like
he was having his little bitch moment.
But didn't she also use him? Because wasn't she using him to try to trick him into getting Patrick dating? Yeah, so she could date the rich bastard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So everybody in that movie was kind of skeezy, except
which
for
Kat. Why I wrote it the way I did. Yeah, she's the only one who didn't know anything. Only was going on.
The pure one in that film. But
that's also kind of how the characters in The Taming of the Shrew are. So
yeah. Yeah, it's constant backstabbery.
I also like that we refer to women as shrews. That's probably...
They do it at least once. Joey calls her a shrew at least once in the movie, and I think that was the his way of, like... I think it's actually right after she backs into his car. This is a weird thing to kind of... to kind of wrap... Oh, did you love how she was looking at Fenders in the, you know, Fender Strats in the guitar store, and as soon as she comes out, the first thing Patrick asks her about the Fenders on her car. there's a cut little subplot from this, and this is, you talk about things that were weird to get into the movie anyway. The fact that the whole flashing the teacher thing got in is weird. What was her name? Mandela, whatever. And Martin, or whatever his name is, Matthew, I don't know. Martin. They were alliterative. There's a cut subplot. So there's a brief mention when he first notices that she's super into Shakespeare. He says something to the effect of, you know, oh, you're like really into him. And she says, we are like together, or we are something like that.
Involved.
We're involved. That's the word. I can never remember. Yeah. Yeah. So there was a cut subplot where she would mention that she had actually tried to kill herself more than once, because she thought that if she did, she could be with William Shakespeare in the afterlife.
I'm glad they cut
that. Which would make sense when they get to prom and she's hunting for William, and she's like, please don't tell me you're going full on delusions now.
Yes. Yeah, so that kind of ties that whole thing together, but boy, it's a weird way of getting there.
Yeah, suicide isn't a funny subplot in a rom-com.
No. I mean, they wanted to make her like weird, and I thought, no, it's okay for her to be quirky without being
suicidal,
extremely over the top, and suicidal.
Don't take my gimmick. I took it from Bob.
I was gonna say Bob right now is twitching somewhere.
He's in the game room. I can see them right now. so great movie. As we end this particular episode of Extras and Epilogues, as we often do, we take the old school approach by the great Siskel and Ebert. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Yes. I give this movie a thumbs up.
Yeah, same.
I agree.
Yeah, in fact, I'm not going to go two thumbs, but I'll definitely go, because I forget that that's how they do it. I go a single thumbs up. I think it's worth looking into. It's not hard to find. It's on Disney Plus right now.
Yep. It's the first thing if you go to movies in alphabetical.
And put in 10. Well, yeah, and if you put in 10, it'll, but you don't have to. It'll do that for you, because it's stylized with the number 10. Can I tell you before we end this how much it bothers me that on the poster, one of the posters for this movie anyway, the tagline is "How do I loathe thee? Let me count the ways."
I remember that.
That's not Shakespeare.
No, it
is. That's Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
No. It wasn't William Shakespeare. It was Tommy Shakespeare.
It was his cousin.
It's his cousin Tommy. Yeah.
It's your Tommy cousin ain't got no Marvin job. Shakespeare. You remember that poem you've been looking for?
Well, listen to this. Hold on, she's flashing the teacher. Give her a second. that's going to wrap up this episode of Extras and Epilogues. Of course, thank you, Lindsay, for coming on and talking about 10 Things I Hate About You. I don't actually hate you. I also recommend listening to 7 Things by Miley Cyrus and 10 Things I Hate About You by Leah Kate? Whatever. I don't know. It's a catchy song. Yeah. Point is, we'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Extras and Epilogues. We're continuing the 1999 trend. Throw me a bone. What horror films are on that list?
So if you want to pull strictly from the list that I have in front of me,
yes.
There's really one major standout.
It's Blair Witch, isn't it?
It's Blair Witch. I mean, there are a couple of other options that are going to fall toward that. Bringing Out the Dead.
That's a good movie.
Is definitely in that sort of vein. If it's not a horror movie, but if you really want some Stephen King, we can do The Green Mile.
That was scary.
The only other things that I can think that would kind of fall toward that would be, well, The Mummy's an action movie. That's not really a horror movie. It's got some jump scare moments, but yeah, I think. And then if you want just existential horror, there's Boys Don't Cry.
No. I'm looking at 1999 horror, and I'm shocked by all of the choices that are on here that aren't in that I think are really good films. Sleepy Hollow was in 1999.
Shit, that's on my list too.
On that one.
Audition.
I went right past it.
Sleepy Hollow, I'm in.
Audition is one that I don't think made the list because it wasn't. Audition wasn't as poignant in 99 as it was in the years afterwards.
Yeah.
It really got, it gained a lot more traction after that.
Schwarzenegger, End of Days, Ravenous is a really underrated horror film. Virus is a terrible film, but I really liked it. But I think for my sake, because I've been wanting to do it for so long. You know what? Before I say the movie that it is, I see there's a really low-key horror film that I think I am the only person that has ever seen. And it's called Resurrection. And it stars Christopher Lambert as a detective who's trying to stop this guy who's like basically building the body of Christ from differently murder people and take their body parts. It's a really good, gritty, nasty horror film. But we're not going to talk about that. Yeah. Next week, we're going to do it. We're going there. Next week, The Blair Witch Project. This is one of the most influential films on me that I can remember. I have so many stories to tell about this movie. I am so excited.
That is one I actually watched before I came out here.
I remember because the pizza man showed up.
Because the pizza man scared us.
Yeah,
because
pizza
we
man.
Were involved in the movie, forgot we ordered pizza, and we just see a shadow go across the window, and then the doorbell rang, and we all screamed.
So that's next week. Blair Witch Project. Tanner will probably be with us once again. Or if he's not available, if we can find any of our other friends that like horror, good luck. But until then, the balcony is closed for myself and for Hunter and for Lindsay. Thank you guys for tuning in, and we will see you next week.